The word alchemy is an Arabic word. It means the art of Egypt. Al meaning art, and Chem meaning it's the old name for Egypt, the land of Chem. So it's the Egyptian art. And it arises out of a whole perception of Egypt, where the ancient Greeks saw Egypt as the source of wisdom. The Greek wisdom, when it collapses in Europe, travels into Arabia and becomes held in the Islamic world. And then this all comes back into Florence in the Renaissance, under the patronage of the Medici. Because what comes back from there is a whole load of manuscripts that are partly Christian, partly pre-Christian, that are Greek, that are Coptic, and this is the sort of what we have to imagine. If you think about the Renaissance, is that all the old Greek learning, the highly advanced society, has collapsed. Right? So if you can imagine literacy almost collapsing in this country and the church taking over and everything being dominated by the church for hundreds of years, and knowledge is defined by the church and defined by religious dogma, that's kind of the situation of the Dark Ages. So Florence, not just Florence, but the other cities, the Renaissance, Milan, Ravenna, become suddenly these places where all this new knowledge. It would be like we'd forgotten to do computing at all, and suddenly, but like the Western world forgets how to understand computers. They've heard of computers, and there's this legends of the computer. And suddenly, but in Saudi Arabia, people are still. Have become very sophisticated in the use of computers, and they've learned the ancient law of the computer, and they keep on teaching it. And somebody from Saudi Arabia brings back manuals and methods of working with computing and a computer. So if you imagine the impact that would have on suddenly a really deep understanding of technology and science and on a community that have lost it. It's magic. It's like a magic coming back. And this is pretty much what happens in the Renaissance. Because it's not just esoteric stuff that comes back. It's mathematical treatises, geometric treatises, medical treatises, understandings of surgery, you name it. It was this, and it's the reason why the Renaissance is this enormous explosion of energy, creativity. You look at somebody like Leonardo da Vinci, whose creativity is exploding in all directions because this enormous sort of injection of new knowledge that isn't new, actually, that's been held that used to exist in Europe, but has been lost in the sort of destruction of the Roman Empire, effectively. So there's a sudden explosion of ideas, and with it is this challenge to the Church of Rome and this idea that the Florentines call the of humanism. You know, this idea that the human being is at the center of the world, and as opposed to God being at the center of the world. So this is a radical heretical idea, and one of the really key central ideas that you find coming out in the Renaissance is this esoteric practice and in something called the Hermetica, because the Hermetica are a selection of documents. Tim Freak has done a wonderful translation of the Hermetica. Actually, they're really dry in the original. But if you're interested in the Hermetica, if you look up the Hermetica and find the translation by Tim Freak, he's done a beautifully poetic kind of poetic translation of it. Because the Hermetica are dialogues, And there's various characters in the dialogues, but one of the word Hermes, of course, comes from the Greek god Hermes originally, who is the god of wisdom, who is the mercurial figure, and who really represents the quality, in lots of ways, of the quality of the imagination. Mercury is also the messenger. He is a sort of angel. He's an archetypal angel, you could say, because he mediates between the divine and the human. Mercury is the god that transmits messages from the gods to human beings, or carries the prayers of the human beings up to the gods. So now what we get is the figure of Hermes, however, that we get in the Hermetica is not this figure. It is Hermes Trismegistus. This is who is regarded as a human being who is an incarnation of the understanding of Hermes, who has the triple mastery. Trismegistus means the one who is the triple master, who has mastered the three worlds. Three worlds being the outer world, the inner world of the soul, and the third world being the divine world, and who can link them all together. These are the three circles of the Tree of Life. And you get these very powerful kind of dialogues, really, between a seeker and Hermes Trismegistus. And there's many different dialogues. One of them is the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, where you get this kind of saying that's become dogmatic in the New Age now. What is above is the same as that which is below, but after another manner. And there's a whole series of aphorisms that follow in the Emerald Tablet, which. That make it one of the foundation documents of alchemy. And the tablet is almost impossible to understand. It's this sort of cryptic comments, you know, and there's a whole legend attached to it in that people, seekers who are go searching for the tomb of Hermes Trismegistus, and they find the Hermetica documents, but they also find this tablet of pure emerald, where these phrases about what is above being the same as what is below, what is within is like what that which is without. Now, what is being described there is the foundation, is the very work that we're talking about, is the capacity to find correspondence between inside and outside, between above and below. It's all there in this kind of diagram, really, where you've got the planets above, the planets below, you've got the figures that are inside the hill, you've got the figures that are above the hill. You've got the three trees, the two trees of the opposite and the one tree that brings them together. You've got fire and water, and you've got the figure that unites fire and water. You've got the four elements with their different energies acting as a sort of a holding frame. But what we're looking at when we look at this diagram, we're looking at the Hermetic cosmos. We're looking at this place where there's always another movement. You move this way, and then there's an opposite movement, and you have to keep working with the dynamic of the opposites. Now, the key thing with there's lots of things we can say about alchemy as it comes out of this, because actually one of the classic thing that alchemy is known for, two things it's known for. One is the philosopher's stone, and the other is the elixir of life. So the idea of the philosopher's stone is you create this thing that turns everything to gold. It's an interesting thing, really, because it's coming out of Greek tradition. We have the legend of King Midas, who asked the gods for this gift to turn everything to gold. And of course, this ancient teaching story of King Midas is that externalizing energy that turns things to gold petrifies and destroys everything. Of course, the reason alchemy takes off in medieval and later Europe is because people want to make gold, basically. Be rich and live forever, right? So the two selling points of alchemy are infinite riches, infinite life. So oddly, it's really kind of like, you know, the sort of promises of the world of advertising, where, you know, you'll be happy all the time and nothing ever goes wrong. So it's this deep tendency in human nature to preserve ourselves and to protect ourselves at all costs. Because, and it's just sort of interesting what happened to the alchemists who set themselves up for that, because actually the ones that did suggest to the world that they were able to make gold all found themselves locked up by the various barons and kings and things and forced to work for them. And in fact, they never do make gold, so they end up in horrible circumstances. You know, so actually, you know, to the literal claiming of that was actually a very dodgy and dangerous thing to do. And of course, if you could make infinite riches, let's say you could do it, I don't think you can, but let's say you could do it, then of course all the nations of the world, all the corporations, all the drug cartels in the world would be after you, because they'd want control of you. So if you did have that capacity, it would be a very dodgy and dangerous thing to possess. Similarly, you know, the elixir of eternal life. God knows what it would be like to live forever. Therefore, watch everybody you know die. You'd end up the loneliest human being in the world if you could do that. You know, and sort of, and so there's something about, you know, these. But of course, that wish in us is, of course, a real wish somewhere. I don't want to die. I don't want anyone I love to die. I want things to stay the same. I want things to be permanent. And I want to be safe, and I would like lots of money, please. It's complicated. Now, the deeper aspect of alchemy, however, which is really what we're looking at, is connected to the idea of paralleling the inside and the outside. Now, there's two basic forms of alchemy, physical alchemy and spiritual alchemy. Physical alchemy, people are actually working with test tubes and flasks and making tinctures. They're actually doing something chemical. And they're normally making herbal tinctures which help life, or there are people who are pursuing the idea of creating the metallic stone that will somehow perfect things. Not very sure about that personally, but anyway. But where they're doing physical alchemy, there is a parallelism between the physical processes and inner processes. So as they work on the outer chemical experiment, they're also seeing that external action as somehow happening inside themselves at the same time. So as the chemicals are fermenting or being dried out or being dissolved, they're contemplating the dissolution or the drying out in their own body, in their own psyche as well. So there are those who work on that level. There are people who, I suppose there are three schools really, if I think about it properly. There's then people who treat it as Jung did, as purely kind of psychological, and will work on the images as sort of inside their own psychology. And then there's the third aspect really, which is pretty much what we're doing, where we're also working on the inner outer, but we're not doing physical experiments, but we are working with the body. So we are the inner, outer, and working with the images are part of an embodied process. So in a sense, our bodies are the alchemical flask. Our bodies are the cauldron. The heat of the purifying fire we are applying to our own, not just a sort of internal contents, but to our experience, our felt sense of the body at the same time. So when we work with the angels, we're not just working in a sort of imaginal way, we're feeling it in our bodies. When the angels stand behind you or to the side of you, you feel that also in your body. When you bless somebody, it's a bodily experience, not just an imaginative experience. Now, the thing that the alchemists are addressing all the time is something they call the prima materia, the first matter. They're trying to produce this mysterious thing called the Philosopher's Stone. And this, one of the things they say about it is the stone is everywhere present. They also say the first matter is everywhere present. Now, one way of understanding that is that the first matter is consciousness itself. And the experience of consciousness is just about noticing what's going on, really, and it's there. It's in fragmented form, it's entangled form, sometimes it's in a clear form. So in a sense, the Philosopher's Stone differs from the first matter only in that it has the first matter gets realigned in a different way through the action of this mysterious energy called the Esh Mezeref, the purifying fire. Now, three things that get purified are the will, the imagination, and the body as a vessel. Now, the book Esh Mezeref, that's why it gives us these two figures. It gives us the image of the ideal alchemist, Elisha, in the beginning. And it gives us this image of Naaman, the leprous kind of warrior. And then it gives us this image of the Jordan with its four directions and the direction of above and below. And it gives us this image of immersion in the Jordan seven times. The other image it gives us is an image of stillness, this Hebrew word tohu, that is somewhere the same as the purifying fire, because it's got the same number, isn't it? So what it says to us is if we place ourselves in the center of the mandala, if we place ourselves between the east and the west and the north and the south and above and below and immerse ourselves seven times, the part of us that is like the man will be healed. And it's another way of describing that is to say that the impure metals in us will become purified. And the image of the purifying fire is also called the refiner's fire, which is where the physical alchemist would heat up slag in order to find the pure metal underneath. So what it's addressing is what the fire is addressing is this tangle of stuff that keeps enmeshing us. And as we apply the energies of fire and water to this, in the way we've been doing this weekend, what happens is these fixed forms, repetitive closed loops, start to open up and dissolve and become, and we start, and as that happens, you start to see the emergence of forms that are more essential, more fluid and clearer than the tangle of stuff. Now the process of alchemy involves these seven processes, right? So the very first process that is described is this thing called calcination, where that energy of heat is applied to it. That's balanced immediately by the other process of solutio, which is the dry stuff then is dissolved in water. Now the whole point about alchemy, just like the spiral and the straight image that we were using last year, is it is a spiral process but also with these moments of intuition of cutting through in it. So these processes, these seven processes, are not linear. They happen in all kinds of different combination. So two of the ones would be calcination and solutio, fire and water. Another set of pair opposites are sublimatio, which is to rise up, and colligato is to incarnate. Right, so you, at times you need to go, so at times you need to heat something, and other times you need to wet it. Sometimes you need to go down into the matter and become solid in it, coagulated in it. Other times you need to sublimate, you need to go up and hold things in a wider kind of view. Another two pair of opposites are separatio and conjunctio. You need to separate things and make them and make difference between things, or you need to make things join together. And the seventh process, which is at the heart of the whole thing, is something called fermentatio, which is the things have to come together and rot down. It's the energy. That's why I say this is a deconstructive work. So the result of it is that things dissolve and rot down into basic elements, and then new life appears. Now, in various alchemical works, you find these processes described as if they're quite linear, and then there's lots of arguments about how many processes, and some people say 12, and some people say 20, and it doesn't really matter. It's just a way of describing, it's a loose framework for describing things that happen, so that we, and it's important we have a sense of that in this process different things happen. It's not about being consistent, because if you're consistent, you stick with one process. So if we say it's very good to bring things together, things must be brought together. I keep saying it all the time, right? But actually, if what's needed is the process of separation to create boundary, then actually the last thing you want is conjunction. You really don't want that. It comes down always to the thing we keep talking about just getting present with what is, and then the alchemical art really is to hold the vessel and to hold yourself as the vessel to bring the whatever presences can help us to help us hold ourselves, and then to aid and abet the process that's trying to happen by bringing it conscious, by bringing our awareness into relationship with it.
Four and five are,
sorry?
Can I ask what 4 and 5 are? Doesn't it matter? You know, you said the first 3 and then you said the 7th one.
Which ones did I say? Calcination and solutio.
Then you said separatio and conjunctio.
Coagulate, the other ones are coagulation and sublimatio. Coagulatio sublimatio. So coagulatio is where you become incarnate, you become you're like more solid. Sublimation is when you rise up. The actual chemical process of coagulation is something coming together to form a sort of a dense body. In sublimation, you're constantly heating and condensing something so that it's continually rising up. Right, so these are basically the chemical processes that have been, or physical processes that have been applied into the realm of soul, really. So the heating things, bringing fire to something, bringing water to something, letting something form so it becomes solid, or gently heating the solid so that it ascends, and so you turn the solid into something more rarefied, something gaseous. Right. So these are the different energies really that work in us as we pursue this. And the, as I say, the basic idea of it is that what we're trying to do is to free our fixated will and cleanse and purify our imagination so that it becomes less obstructed by all the forms and the patterns of the past. And so it's quite a difficult job, because you have to, so this practice that we've been doing all weekend of just being present in the body, creating the vessel, inviting the angels to stand with us, and then bringing whatever needs attention into the vessel. Because whatever is brought into the vessel then comes into this fire of awareness. Now, how the alchemical metaphors are, which is the bit you find in the middle here, where because you're working really with the underneath of things. And so these figures that you have in the middle represent the alchemical metals. Earth is just there, so earth is the whole thing, so you're in the earth. So you have the figure in the center playing the lyre is the sun, representing gold. Then you have Mercury. So Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, the Moon and Saturn, Sun in the center. Around it you have the sphere of the stars. So what you have really, if you look at, so we've got the Moon is pretty much silver, Sun is gold, Saturn is lead, Jupiter is tin, Mars is iron, Venus is copper, Mercury is the element Mercury. So now from an alchemical way, we know these obviously as metals, there's a lot more metals, but from an alchemical point of view, these metals that are found in the earth, they would say, are also found in the body, and they are actually found as trace elements in the body, the major metals. And they would say, because above is like as below, the metals are reflections in the body and in the earth of these deep archetypal principles. So if you are going to transform yourself, you have to bring the fire. The way they would look at it is these metals are all mixed up in this sort of slag inside you, this embedded mess, which is the tangle that we find in the tree. Now, as you apply the alchemical methods to the stuff, the pure metals start to emerge and start to, and it's a bit like the tree of life emerging from inside a tangle. So you start to see them, and so then the different spheres of the tree of life can start to relate to each other and find balance, and appropriate flow can start to happen, because in the beginning the flows are twisted, the wrong things are connected to the wrong things. Flow doesn't happen, and there's too much flow in some places, no flow in other places. So our internal ecology is disturbed. So the alchemical process then is an attempt, you could say, to restore our internal ecology, and so that our relationship to inside and outside, and so that the flow works. Now, we'll come back to the book Esh Mezaref next time, so I just want to explore it a little at a time. But the thing that it leads on to, from the place we began, is it starts to apply the metals to the Tree of Life in a lying sort of way. because it the thing about these documents is that they have to be explained. So if you read them, what you will find is that he gives completely different attributions to the metals than the ones I've just given you. And he's done that in whoever wrote this has deliberately tangled up the attribution of the metals to the Sephiroth to stop you getting an understanding of it without it being explained to you. One of the, and come to them in just a second, but he says that I have delivered you the key to unlock many secret gates, and I have opened the door to the innermost secret of nature. But if anyone places these things in another order, I shall not contend with them, inasmuch as all systems tend to the one truth. So one of the hints that's given there is, I've said all this, but actually there might well be another way of looking at it. the subtlety of this particular book is that there is another way of looking at it, because it doesn't, if we use his methods, they will be quite complicated for us, and we'll go astray. However, in the order that has been suggested, there are some hints about what the work is really about. I'll explain a little bit, not too much, because we're at the end of the weekend and it's a bit head-banging. Okay, he says, for example, so in the classic situation, lead is in the place of Bina, the archetypal feminine. It's in Saturn. Now, the element of lead is this great containing element. So it's a sort of, lead is a sort of, is dense, it's got this quality of holding inside it. Now, the archetypal feminine is the archetypal womb, the archetypal imagination that above all is this capacity to contain and hold, and out of which form can happen. Lead is a metal that can be formed, that can be shaped. It's a soft metal. So it has a lot of qualities that you would associate with the quality of Bina, which is this archetypal feminine sphere. He, however, says that lead is found in Chokmah, which is the archetypal masculine. So he's deliberately reversed the normal order. And he says that Bina, which is the archetypal feminine, is tin, because it's old, and it shows its oldness because it crackles. Now it's fairly specious sort of argument, and anyone understanding alchemy and the metals and the attribution of the metals and the qualities of the tree would know that just wasn't true. And he places gold in the place of Mars, he places silver in the place of Jupiter. But what he does in the doing of that is sort of interesting, because the whole energy of this particular text is a fire of fusion. The purifying fire fuses and brings opposites together, and through the holding of opposites, so he takes the metal of the archetypal feminine metal, he places it in the archetypal masculine place. Now, if we believe him in a cognitive way, we'll go astray. But if we bring together the energy of Chokmah with the idea of lead, what then starts to happen is ignition. You start to get a sort of a fiery will that can melt and start to form the lead and begin the creative process. Now, what was all the rest of it? Because it's too late in the day. We need to take it little by little. But the point of a text like this, it's a hypertext, like a hypertext in a computer. You're intended to engage with little bits of it, engage with your imagination. There are bits of it that you have to be told. So you have to know the correct order of the metals, otherwise it doesn't make sense. But if you do know the correct order of the metal, then it leads you on to thinking of, well, why has he put that there? Is there some reason? And then if you start to think about why he's put that there, then it sets off trains of thought and feeling inside you, which give you clues into the deeper process. Now, he's put gold in Mars. Now, that gold is the metal above all that you're trying to get to. So, and you know, if you know about these things, that actually the place of Mars is the metal iron. It's the warrior, it's the sword of iron, it makes no sense to have gold there. But the hint that he gives there is this book is all about bringing into fruition that martial part of our being, which is the deep will. And there's all kinds of hints and poetic kind of riddles really that are given in the book that we'll go through this year little by kind of little. And I'll probably give you a copy of it next time, but I don't want to horrify you all. Because we've kind of got to get to the understanding of this alchemical way of thinking before we get into too much of the detail of the book. Because it generally is headbanging. But it's like it's headbanging in the same way that the poem was headbanging last year. But there you have to decode something, you have to understand a way of thinking and being, which is what we've been doing in the practices. So the key of the work of this weekend really are these alchemical practices and this work with the angels that we've been doing. The more we can understand that, the more we get to understand the alchemical way of thinking and being. And then when we come to look at an alchemical book, which is a set of lab notes in a way, really, of ways of reminding us or helping us to deepen the work. Because as the progress of this book goes on, I won't go through the detail of it, but you, having established a sort of basic approach to the metals, you then immediately starts to talk about this relationship with the sphere of Mars to the quality of gold, and a process of transformation of gold through applying the martial energy to it, which is this fiery kind of will. And the other thing I'll come back to all of that, but, and having done that, he then immediately from gold goes to silver. Right, so you work with gold, work with gold, work with gold. Then you have to look at silver. What's silver? Silver is the opposite of gold. It's the other side of gold. It's the other metal. So then you have to learn about the nature of silver. And we won't go into the detail of it. Because in silver, the thing about gold is that you are getting rid of all the kind of forms to expose the pure gold. With silver, you're much more in the realm of the moon, of form, and so there's a lot of stuff about the forms that arise out of silver. Because with silver, we're sort of looking at the imagination. And so there's a lot of animal imagery in the part of the book when you come to looking at silver, because you're looking at the purification of the imagination and therefore looking at the forms that rise out of that. So we're really learning to understand what happens in the imagination. We then go into the metal tin, which is all about the process of separation. I mean, tin is this metal that sheaths things. You know that if you put things in tins to preserve things, it's an inert metal that can be used that is very good at creating a barrier between things, that it's bendy, it can be sealed, it will not contaminate what it holds. So there you're starting to look at the whole process of separation and boundary and creating a vessel. This is deepened then by looking at the element of bronze or brass, which is a combination of tin and copper, and which it is about looking at how you work with opposites and how you create forms which arise out of the conjunction of two different qualities. Copper is a soft metal, tin is a hard metal. So having done separatio last time, you're then looking at conjunctio, how do you bring things together? Again, you wouldn't know that without me telling you, because it's sort of, you have to get into the process a bit more. And having done that at that kind of level, we're then looking at the opposites of the primal masculine and the primal feminine. And in particular, we start to look at the idea of lead. So we're looking at the kind of at this sort of now if Saturn, which is the element of lead, is the outermost part of the solar system. So you're looking at the vessel that contains everything. So you're looking there at this process of containing the whole alchemical process and what it is to create the vessel. You're also looking at the image there of the goddess of wisdom, who is the creative, who alongside the divine masculine creates the universe. Having done that, and having understood these deeper kind of processes, earlier processes, you then suddenly brought back to the idea of the River Jordan and the idea of Mercury, which is this fluidic kind of principle that joins things together. And you're looking, in a way, they make reference to one river that flows north to south, another river that flows south to north. So again, it's another way of looking at opposites and looking at this process of immersion, and describing also the actual element of Mercury as the liquid metal, the metal that is a metal that is also a liquid. So it's solid and is liquid at the same time. And you start to look there as well in the mercurial thing at the idea of because one of the qualities of Mercury is that it cleans things, it absorbs impurities. So you look in the mercurial work at the place of something called the kings and queens of Edom, which are the unbalanced or split off parts of ourselves, all of which have to be brought back into the river. They have to be brought and immersed into the Jordan. So we need there's a whole lot of work there about dealing with disturbance in ourselves, disturbance in the world, and the necessity for that to be brought into the flow of life so that it doesn't spin off on its own. And then finally, you're given the image of a dove. And the coming together of the sun and the moon, and the idea that the dove is not applied to the metals themselves, but is the ministering and preparing form of nature. So the dove represents this energy of awareness that is sort of somehow, and it's a bit like this image of the Holy Spirit descending upon Jesus in the Jordan. The dove is this image of the holy breath, in a sense, that actually is working the whole process, and the thing that we're cooperating with. So that's a really fast run through Esh Mezeref, right, which is a sort of, so that's a sort of a sense of the whole alchemical process. Because actually, what happens at the end is this image of the. Let's just describe it quite nicely here at the end. That the moon may be as the sun, and the sun may be as the moon. And thus the work is mystically finished. For the sun, it has now a lunar splendor, and the moon has also a solar splendor. So the different aspects of our nature, which are in a way, sake of argument today, we could say that the will and the imagination have acquired some of each other's qualities. The fixated and over-aggressive will has developed the flexibility and the fluidity of the moon. The moon has acquired the fiery and incandescent energy of the deep will. So, and we're left in the hands, if you like, of the ministering dove. So we are then, in a sense, open to that kind of deeper place of breath that continually looks after us, continually hovers over us, bringing us into the bringing us into wherever we need to go and be. And in fact, you're called in the end. He said, you enter in, what's that great phrase? Enter into the house of many prayers. Yeah, then talks about the work that you can do in the world, that you can, because this you have this quality of sulfur, which is the fire, it is the purifying fire. your ways are right before the Lord, your iron shall swim in the water for you. He who has entered into the house of the paths shall understand the extraction of the sulphur of gold and iron, the extraction of which is taught by many and is of easy, also of gold, of iron, of brass, of gold, iron, copper, and antimony, which are gathered together by vinegar, out of this extraordinary word called lixivium, which I have no idea what that means, which are changed into a red oil with a tinge of silver. For there is a treasure to be desired, and oil to be found in the dwelling of a man of wisdom. Now, it's a very poetic and frankly quite obscure way of talking about the you are then the person who has entered into the house of paths, who has brought together the who really has brought together opposites, and who has possesses this oil of anointing, which is red and silver, and that is used in blessing. So you become this person that can anoint the world with blessing, and who can find the sulphur of things. And the sulphur is the spirit of things, who has the capacity to go into the form of things and find the spiritual essence and anoint it and bring that out. So the image is of someone who is constantly, not by act, but just by nature, by being, able to bring a sense of blessing and fertility to the world around yourself. But the practice of it, so it's very complicated when I put it like that, but the practice of it is just as we have been doing this weekend. It's this practice of containment, of creating the vessel, of inviting the angels in to help us hold it, and then just to be present in it, and just to keep breathing, to bring the inside and the outside together, and then to just follow that catalytic action. You know, an image that can help really is that image of the we're cooperating with the ministering dove, that deeper kind of presence. The presence, in a way, you could say, of the angel that we encountered last weekend. It's just a different word for it. And in a way, it's a sort of a patient kind of practice. Now, if you want in the month to work with it, the best thing to do is not to take very long. Take 10 minutes, 5-10 minutes. Sit with your chalice, have a nightlight or something, and a little bit of water. And just work gently with alchemizing your environment. You know, the key thing to do is to just come into your body, get present in the senses, feel the act of holding, notice, close your eyes, feel the inside and the outside. Play a little bit with that movement inside and outside till it becomes a felt experience. If it feels right to you, you can invite the four archangels to be with you to help you hold the process. And then just alchemize your life, whatever bits of your life, whether it's something inside you or something outside you. Place it in there for a moment and just sit with it. Sit in the stillness with it then. Breathe with it, see what happens. And treat whatever happens as significant. Okay, as an experiment, for those 5 or 10 minutes. So if nothing appears to happen, get interested in the particular quality of nothing. Treat everything that happens as somewhere significant. Again, as an experiment, make a note of it and then just see how it travels. And get interested as well, it's just in the qualities of the chalice and of the fire and the water. Just literally contemplate the flame, contemplate the water and the principle of reflection. Feel the solidity of the chalice, feel its holding capacity. You know, notice, even look at the design on the chalice, which is this, has this kind of squareness surrounded by roundness. And so, you know, the underneath idea of this is that there are these opposites, and then the third factor is of presence and awareness. So as two things come together, there is a third presence, which is the witnessing, but it's an engaged witnessing. It's not the... So it's different from things like mindfulness, where you back away from the object. Okay? Here you move towards it and put your and wrap your awareness around it. You make it part of you. So you're not trying to disengage, you're engaging. You're bringing the insight together with. And in that moment, you're working with the prince, the process of conjunctio, of conjunction. By doing it for a limited period of time, 10 minutes, no more, you work with the principle of separation. As you penetrate the thing with awareness, which you could say is an aspect of coagulation going into it, you will sometimes feel insights or space will emerge around it, which is this sublimation kind of idea. The work will sometimes feel very soft and dissolving, like a solutio. Other times it'll feel very fiery and dynamic, which is like the calcination thing. Just get interested in the particular... it's a bit like if you are your own experiment here. So if you're doing it outside yourself, you would just get interested in this process that would keep on happening. And in particular, get interested in this underneath process of fermentation or of things loosening up and dissolving and breaking down to allow new life to come up. You know, it's a bit like letting the tangle rot away and then there's room for the new shoots. Or breaking down the cover over the well so the spring can flow again or something. You know, that's the sort of process that we're looking at here. So that's what fermentation is all about. It's about letting things rot down, and nothing is wasted in that process. So the important thing is to let whatever is there to be there. If hate is there, let hate be there. If coldness is there, disgust is there. So bringing in the shadow qualities just as much as their so-called positive qualities. And just practice it a little each day, just seeing how, you know, seeing what you find. So that's Alchemy 101. It's, you know, if you read books on alchemy, it can be described as a very complicated practice, but it doesn't have to be complicated. Yeah, surely. Have you had enough? You look absolutely knackered.
No more.
No more. That's